Good afternoon, and welcome to the November meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, coming to you today from Hedges Hall at Point Lookout in Northport on the Midcoast of Maine. And a particular warm welcome to our public radio audience reaching us through the good offices of the Maine Public Broadcasting Network, MPBN. I'm Tom DeMarco, filling in for Mac DeFord, our president. Mac is in Beirut at the moment. Founded in 1983, the Forum is now celebrating its 31st year. That's more than 30 years of bringing you on a monthly basis informed speakers on all aspects of foreign affairs and U.S. diplomatic policy, sometimes the lack of a policy. This is meeting number 380. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. Today we're delighted to be able to bring you Suki Kim. Suki is an author, a teacher, a journalist, and as you will see, an intrepid adventurer. She has written two books. The first of these was a novel called The Interpreter, which came out from Random House a few years back. And her second book, the subject of today's talk, is the book about her experience teaching in North Korea. Since Suki's going to be talking about that book, I thought I'd take 1 minute to give you a 1 minute review of her earlier book, The Interpreter. It's the story of a Korean woman, young woman, living in New York and working as an interpreter in the New York court system. In the course of her work, she's dealing with people who are often impoverished, often elderly, often illegal Korean immigrants living in the Bronx and in Queens and elsewhere in New York. In other words, people who come from the very milieu that her parents lived and worked in up to their death a few years before. Their death is slightly mysterious to her. She's trying to figure out what happened. And in the course of an interview, in an amazing scene in which she's interpreting, but also asking a question of her own in the guise of interpreting, she elicits a clue from someone who knew her parents. And she follows that clue where it leads, which is into the deep, dark underbelly of the immigrant community in New York. I read this with fascination and got completely engrossed. It's a page-turner. It's a wonderful book. Pick it up. If you're a novel reader, you won't go far wrong on that one. Let me turn to the second book, which again is on sale here. Be sure to pick up a copy, and Suki will sign it for you. Without You, There Is No Us. The title comes from a song, a mantra, that the Koreans, North Koreans, are obliged to sing or recite all the time. Without you, there is no us. The you here is their precious leader. Now, if that very idea doesn't make your blood run cold, stay tuned, because there's a lot more to come. Suki Kim.
Thank you so much for having me here to your beautiful state, I guess. The drive here from Portland was just absolutely stunning, so I'm honored to be here. So to start a talk on my second book, the experience that led to it, I'm going to start with actually a video which gives you a little taste. If you can play this, Without You, There Is No Us.
The video shows a series of propaganda stills over subtitles in English of the words of the anthem. I will voice over the subtitles for you as they appear on the screen. You made us believe, Comrade Kim Jong-il. We are unable to live without you. Our country is unable to survive without you. Our future and hope depend on you. people's fate depends on you. Comrade Kim Jong-il. We are unable to live without you. Our country is unable to survive without you.
So I think the theme is pretty clear. Also, I don't know if you noticed that, but the second half of that video that is all about USA, actually, United States of America, being the axis of evil and the ultimate enemy that needs to be crushed down to pieces. And this song is pretty much their national anthem that you hear it all the time. It became a title of my book, Without You, There Is No Us. 당신이 없으면 우리도 없다, which is the title of the song, because I heard it so often. And I would hear it, you know, the students that I taught in Pyongyang, I heard it like 3 times a day. You know, they would march to the cafeteria for meals 3 times a day, often singing these songs. And I heard it so often, it almost felt like home to me. So, you know, even years later, I would sometimes hum it. I live in Manhattan, on the streets of Manhattan, feeling some sort of warmth for home. And then I would realize what the song is. I mean, it's that common, that song, which is interesting because which I'll get to, but I covered, I don't know if you remember, the New York Philharmonics in Pyongyang. I covered that for Harper's Magazine, and everyone thought, I wrote a really long piece for Harper's about that experience, which about 100 journalists went to. Probably the world's top journalists were all there on that trip. And I followed the Philharmonic around. I was traveling with them for about a week through their Asia tour. And then by the time we got to Pyongyang, and they made a really big deal out of Lauren Mazel conducting, and that American anthem and North Korean anthem was being played. I don't think a single journalist realized on that trip that that wasn't really their national anthem. You know, the official national anthem of North Korea has nothing to do with their real national anthem. Their real national anthem is this song and the song of great leader Kim Jong-il. Those are their national anthem. So, you know, North Korea being one of the most, if not the most inaccessible place in the world, is also one place that is impossible to write about because of things like that. What looks a touching occasion on paper, which that Philharmonic, what I call a perfect show, seemed to be, was in fact nothing but a show. Because that touching moment had nothing to do with the reality of what was really going on, which was that a lot of press wasted their money being sucked into North Korea's propaganda show, which was this fake peace moment that was being showcased for the world to see, ended up being the front page of every single newspaper around the world. At the same time, the real tragedy and violations against humanity that was being perpetrated in North Korea did not actually make the papers that time. So anyway, this whole topic of North Korea, I'll talk about how it came about, was that I went there. I was born and raised in South Korea. I come from a family that was torn apart by the war. So Korean War, which lasted from 1950 to 1953, which ended up being paused rather than ended at now what we call DMZ, the 38th parallel, about 1 million-plus families were separated. So Korea, which was is a traditionally a Confucian Buddhist nation. You know, Confucianism is all about families, 5,000-year-old kingdom, then got artificially separated by, which I think probably a lot of you know, by Russia and the United States, which actually really created North Korea. And I mean, at the end of Cold War, as a colonial remapping. But that political decision, which really happened, actually started from Cairo Conference, when they all decided to cut up Korea after the occupation by Japan. I think the UK and China and the United States, the allies, decided to cut the country up, and that temporary division stuck and did not lift for 70 years. So when we talk about a million plus families, you know, it was a line that just kind of came, got drawn. My grandmother, at the time, her oldest child was 17, who was my uncle, my mom's the youngest. He was taken away during the whole evacuation process, and was last seen being taken away by the North Korean soldiers, and never was seen again. And my grandmother basically waited for him to come home, because there had never been a division. So they didn't know, that generation, that this was something that was gonna stick. So she thought he was coming home next week, and next week, and next week. She never moved her house, because she thought he wouldn't find her way back, and basically waited. I think I have a chapter in the book where she died of a heartbreak, really, whatever her illness was. But that's one mother out of a million. And I think ultimately people always ask me, why did I go to North Korea? I think I needed to make a sense out of this division. That generation, we still have 70 years later, that division is still there. So what that means is that generation of mothers, sons, or I can't imagine how frightening it would have been for my uncle, for example, to end up on the other side of the border in the middle of nowhere and never got to go home. And so I think that generation lived out their lives and pretty much all died. So then how do you make sense of that sorrow, human sorrow, that's behind what we now have, South and North Korea, this political surface of, the world politic issue, but beyond that is a human issue. And it, in order to understand that, or for me as a writer, explain it, in a way that is responsible, what I mean is in-depth reporting, I needed to go there. So in 2002, I went there for the first time. It's hard to go to. I know some of you probably went to North Korea. You always go with an organization. So I went, I joined pro-Kim Jong-il organization back in 2002 in order to get in. Because I knew they would see the side of North Korea that other people don't get to see. What I found there was heartbreaking and shocking and impossible to make sense of. You know, it's a place where you arrive and minders take you. You never see anything on your own. Back in 2002, which came soon after the worst famine, which killed a tenth of their population, North Korea has a population of about 25 million. So a tenth of the population, they say more, is over 2 to 3 million people died of famine. So in 2002, when I went in, they had no, they didn't even have electricity proper in the airport. I slept with my coat on, because I was part of this organization that was pro Kim Jong-il. I was treated to a VIP quarters, and not even a hotel, but VIP quarters, and that didn't even have electricity, so I slept with a coat on. And that whole week was about for Kim Jong-il's 60th birthday celebration. And I was just taken one after another of these Kim Jong-il events, which had to do with Kim Jong-il flower exhibition. There's a flowers named after the great leader. I was taken to Juche classes. Juche is their political foundation philosophy, meaning self-reliance. You know, that sounds all good, self-reliance, but all that means is isolationist approach. So they just constantly teach you Juche stuff. So going through that, and people were dancing constantly, I'll show you some photos of that, constantly on the street. It was so cold. You know, it's like minus, it reaches minus 40 there. and people were didn't even have proper, you know, real heavy clothes and just dancing for like 10 hours to celebrate. So I didn't really understand what this world really was. So I needed to go back, and I went back to Philharmonic. I also went back with another organization. So I went to North Korea for 5 times throughout a decade looking for a chance to live there. I realized that's the only way, you know? If you go as a part of a media tour, you're getting a packaged version. That's a government propaganda, like the Philharmonic concert. You know, that's like going into Disney World and interviewing Cinderella. There's just no point of doing that, because it's okay if you go and interview Cinderella for Disney World thinking you're investigating Disney World, which is, you know, is very laughable. So when you see things like CNN behind the veil of North Korea, I mean, anybody you're talking to has been handpicked by the government and sort of parroting whatever is supposed to be said. It's according to a script. So what kind of an investigation is that? Or if you are like AP, they're reporting on what the government selects for you so that you become the voice to spread it around the world. I mean, that's being a PR agent for the world's most brutal dictatorship, which the UN had just declared as the worst possible violations of it against humanity in a contemporary world that is unsurpassed. So in order to not do that stuff as a writer, which I think is unconscionable to repeat Kim Jong-un regime's propaganda out to the public, because as a writer, we have a responsibility. So I looked for an opportunity to go undercover. Found that in 2011 through this organization that I courted for a number of years. It was a group of evangelical Christians, international organization that had cut a deal, some unofficial deal, with the North Korean regime to go and set up a school. They promised to not proselytize. But they were funding, the school took about $35 million to build and to operate it, obviously a lot more. And whatever money that is being handed over to the regime, we have no proof of that. No teachers get paid because they're all being, you know, sponsored by churches wherever they come from. And they're from all over the world, you know, New Zealand, UK, United States, obviously. Generally not South Koreans, because not at least South Koreans by nationality. They'll be like South Korean Canadian, South Korean New Zealander. So ethnically it was about half and half non-Korean to Korean, someone like me who's American, but of South Korean origin. And these teachers did not get paid, and they were allowing this school to operate in Pyongyang for whatever reason. So I joined that faculty pretending to be an evangelical Christian and to go with them, organization, and also a teacher, which I'm not. So so undercover journalism is the only way that you can write about North Korea with any truth and dignity and honesty. So I went there in 2011. And that year, so North Korea counts their calendar system differently from the rest of the world. So they count their calendar from the birth of their original great leader, Kim Il-sung. There have been now been 3 generations. So there was a Kim Il-sung, this man here that I just showed, it was Kim Jong-il, and then currently the world's youngest leader, Kim Jong-un. So they count their calendar system from the birth of Kim Il-sung. So, and they would always say Juche year, whatever. 2011 was Juche year 100. That year that I went. In order to celebrate Juche year 100, they shut down every university in the whole country and put all the university students in construction field for a year. And then the reason they gave was to build a powerful and prosperous nation, which is their slogan. But they left 270 young men of all the sons of elite. They they took them out of their existing schools, which were Kim Il-sung University in Pyongyang, Kimchak University in Pyongyang. These are MIT and Harvard of North Korea. They plucked young men out of the schools and some regional schools that are, I guess, best in their state, and put them away in Pyongyang University of Science and Technology, which is where I was. So that year, you know, when I heard about this happening, all the universities are getting shut in North Korea, it was barely being reported, because news on North Korea are often unreliable. Because no one's getting in, you know, no one's getting the information of what's really going on in there. But then it turned out to be true when I was in North Korea. When I realized that, and I realized my students are the only ones who are not in construction fields, I mean, that would show that these are the creme de la creme of North Korea, clearly. Everybody else is doing manual labor. So these are the sons of the Workers' Party leaders. So why is this happening? It's all in the book. I did realize something big is happening in this country. Sure enough, by the end of that year. Also, that year was the year of Arab Spring. So all the youth around the world were rising up against their regimes. But North Korea scattered them instead in construction fields. So I did realize something's going to happen here. And sure enough, by the end of that year, Kim Jong-il died. And Kim Jong-un rose to power. I was in Pyongyang when Kim Jong-il died. So they were getting ready for the regime change. And they hid, sheltered these young men who were going to be the future leaders of North Korea. And those are the young men that I ended up spending all my time with in this suburban campus in Pyongyang that was guarded by the military. And I mean, obviously it's not a school if it's being guarded by the military. And they were never allowed out of the campus. Teachers, there were about 30 of us, were only allowed out in a van with a minder on like a weekend for a couple of hours. And we were allowed out to visit the Great Leader Monuments. In North Korea, it doesn't matter where you're taken to, they're all related to the Great Leader. So we were taken to an apple farm, but which is a 12th wonder of North Korea, because the Great Leader praised it. Great Leader created it. It's the apples that Great Leader blessed. It's the best apples in the world. Well, from talking to my students, they built it. Pyongyang students were rounded up to go build this apple farm a couple of years back. But for example, like that apple farm, none of my students were allowed to ever see after they were building it. It was half an hour from the campus. So even the sons of elite were not allowed to go anywhere. So the things I found by living there with them, because covering North Korea, it doesn't come from interviewing them. They will never tell you what they're thinking. They will never tell you what is really their lives, because it's a system built on fear, because everybody's watching. So in that, the general world of their world was that they only have one television channel. It doesn't matter if they say there are three channels, it's really one is normally working. There are three, but the others like generally are not working. And one shows from 5:30 to 11:30 only programs on the Great Leader. And those programs are not news. Even if it's news, it would be photo reels of whatever they selected. So there is no, you know, the number one rule of news usually is the current, you know, time. So usually North Korean news, you don't know when it happened. So, I mean, there are things subtly what they do, which is because Great Leader is like God. It's deified. So if it's going to be like a God, then it has to be a bit fake, because he's not like a human being on some level. So they have this television, it's the only way people get information, although electricity is so spotty in the rest of North Korea that you don't really get to watch television much. Their newspaper is only one newspaper, and that newspaper is 6 pages long, and every article is the Great Leader, on the Great Leader. All the books are only by the Great Leader. Songs, obviously you heard one song, this is very typical of all North Korean songs, are Great Leader songs. Education. They study Juche every day, so the foundation philosophy. So my students, for example, every single day marched off to this Kim Il-sung-ism center on campus where we were not allowed to enter, the teachers. And in there, they learned their great leader studies. And they guard that building 24/7. So six students of mine would take turns. And it's freezing in North Korea, generally with no heat. So it's an empty building, but it's a place of worship in a way. So they guard that. That would be one of their duties. There's a great leader. So my students also had tons of duties. There's a great leader tower, which says on the stone tower, which says, our great leader is forever with us. And that would be decorated with the designs of the great leader flowers at the bottom, and they would have to wash that with buckets of water. That would be another, for example, duty that they had. So these things basically occupy their time. North Koreans, I spent years, other than going into North Korea for the preparation of this book, I also got a Fulbright grant to live in South Korea. You know, I'm from there, but as an adult, I've never lived there. So I needed to live there. I lived there for about 14 months, interviewing every defector. Later, I got the George Soros Foundation grant in order to travel around the region. I went to Mongolia, Thailand, Laos, to enter China, the borders of China, to interview all the defectors. There are about hundreds of thousands of defectors who flee into China, and then they make their way to South Korea. Interviewing them for about, I did a piece for Harper's about that. Interviewing them, a lot of them, which they, most of them come from the bottom rung of North Korea. Because when you think about it, North Korea is, another key fact is that they're not allowed to move within the country. We know they cannot leave the country, or people from outside can only come in through some sort of permission. But they also don't move within the country. There are checkposts between each towns. So you don't go anywhere. So that's why people haven't really been anywhere. So when you interview defectors, they haven't actually, you know, that's a best way of controlling people. If actually people cannot physically move, but also there's no information, because when you think about it, well, also there's no internet, you know? I mean, that's another key thing. My students, computer majors, it's a Pyongyang University of Science and Technology. They didn't know the existence of the internet. When you talk to them, they say they know what it is, but then they don't know. They think that, intranet, which is like pre-selected in links that the government has already created that's pre-selected, so you click on it and then it goes to whatever they want to show you, they think that's the internet. So it's like you're miscommunicating, and they would ask me things like, at some point they realized there was some difference between their internet and my internet, and they would ask me things like, so how many movies can you see on this internet? And how long is that movie? You know, I mean, like that question alone right away would show you that they don't know what it is. But that only comes from living with them, because on surface, the school would show us like 10 students sitting in front of a Google page to say our world, you know, we have the internet, but realistically speaking, you know, all you have to do is type Kim Jong-un and then you find everything, right? So there's a constant charade and theater. But when you interview defectors, that's one thing that is common. I remember, it's a very exhaustive research. They don't have the time, you know? Wherever they are in North Korea, first of all, most of them come from the border region, because Pyongyang is very, I mean, the map of Korea is that DMZ is right smack in the middle of Korea. And Seoul, the capital of South Korea, which is one of now richest countries in the world, you know, went so opposite South Korea and North Korea. And North Korea, Pyongyang, is right above DMZ, like 2 hours away. So what that means is their capital is very, very south of North Korea. So most defectors come from actually the border, which is the topmost region, very far from their capital. The capital is a selected city of where all the elites are. But defectors generally come from the border region, and they cross over because it would be almost impossible to escape passing so many checkposts. So you get all the border pictures, but one thing you do have in common when you are interviewing them is that they don't have a lot of time. Because people I think when we come from this world, you wonder, do they not think something's wrong with it? They might, but they're so busy. You know, their hours are mapped out. They also, every North Korean, including my students, has a thing called daily unity critique. What that is you're all assigned to watch someone else. And once a week, you report in a public critique on each other. So what that means is my students, for example, were all in pairs. And I thought they were just best friends. Slowly, you realize they all sit next to each other. Back in the dormitory, their beds are next to each other. They, you know, it's literally, you don't see them separate. And that is also good friendship, but also it's a buddy system. So you don't know, you're always being watched. And that sense of being watched is possibly the most draining thing, but also the most frightening thing. You know, one time a student of mine, I had to eat all my meals with them. So it was me and actually three students, which is another interesting thing that they arranged because it's a bit, usually obviously a bit buddy, but then there's a one person who's separated from the buddy because in case the buddies get too close during a meal, another person is watching in that three system. So that you only realize by living with them. For example, because they didn't know anything, they didn't have the internet, they were so busy doing this great leader duty, like soldiers, you know, it's like mapped out from 5:30 until they go to bed. All group activities that, you know, on birthdays, how they celebrate was they said back in the dormitory, they all get up and sing songs one by one, by one. And I would be like, what kind of songs do you sing then? And they always say songs about the great leader or songs about friendship. One time a student said rock and roll and just went quiet. That, you know, it's those moments of fear that I'd never seen. It's an unfamiliar fear because he just turned white, lowered his face, and just watched to see who else might have heard this. And I think this kind of, I mean, where you can't even, as a 19-year-old, those boys were ages of 19 and 20, not being able to say what music you listen to without feeling such primary fear, you know, it's a different level of watchfulness, whatever the punishment might be that exists for them. So that system of constantly spying on each other and the fact that you're never allowed to physically move, these things of worship, also their educational level, these were the Pyongyang's best and the brightest. They would say things that made absolutely no sense. You know, they thought basketball makes them grow tall, certain, as scientists. But this is what they get taught. And there were so many of this nonsense that they would repeat back to me, and I realized at some point that it's impossible to teach anything if you cut out the rest of the world from information. How can you teach literature, history, geography, art, philosophy? And there's nothing, even computer, without mentioning the internet. So what are they teaching in their schools? Because in order to continue this system of the great leader, you can't educate students because education would lead to revolution and awareness, which is what they don't want. So I think that these are the things, I mean, I really began to love them because 19 is also 19. They're most, you know, adorable, funny. You know, I'm a female teacher in an all-male school, 270 of them. You know, they would make jokes that were hilarious. And I would assign things constantly to try to teach them or find out, not teach them, because teaching them actually made me nervous. And that was, I think, in the book constantly, whatever I teach them, how is that going to help them? It might get them killed. You know, I think I'm awakening a student, but that awakening in this world of Kim Jong-un, then Kim Jong-il, would only either kill them or their family, or bring unhappiness for life. And I think that sense of what I was there for and what we think is so easy in the rest of the world, thinking why are North Koreans not rising up against our government, when you're in there, seems almost an impossible thing to do. And for the, what we think is revolution, you need a lot of things. You need a movement, a way to organize people, but you also need education to back it up. You need information to spread, none of which is there. Also, you also have another thing, which is controlling people's soul by absolutely tightening this image of the great leader, which is like a cult religion. It's a fanatic cult religion. Every citizen wears the badge of the great leader. Every room in North Korea has pictures of North Korean, both of them, Kim Jong-il and Kim Il-sung on the wall, or their sayings. In the school, they showed movies. The only movies we were allowed to show were March of Penguin and Lion King. These the movies that don't show people or the world. They're cartoon or national, nature documentary. When we were trying to project the film, we couldn't find a blank space because you can't move these portraits on the wall. You're not allowed. So they're looking around the whole campus. You couldn't find a blank space. So we could only show like half the size that you could show it. And that is actually how North Korea is. You know, when we were taken to teachers, because also minders lived on campus on the ground floor, their job was to watch us. Teachers did have the connection to the internet. But they were heavily monitored connection by the minders. They, there were a group of North Korean staff called counterparts that I had to get every lesson plan approved by. All the classroom was bugged, and all the students, there were three students assigned. I never found out who were those individual students to report on me. So you also, as a teacher, know everything I'm saying is being noted and being reported. And that system where we were taken, teachers were taken to North Korea's most famous mountains, Geumgang Mountain and Myohyang Mountain, these are prized mountains of the Korean people. You know, South Koreans dream of one day visiting. And people who are from South Korea, North Korea originally, who ended up in South Korea, it's like their hearts, literally, that's all they talk about. One day I'll see with my own eyes Mount Geumgang. When you go to those mountains, there are no North Koreans on them. My students had never been on those mountains. Even these elite kids were not allowed. Instead, what you find in those mountains are every surface is a great leader slogan. Literally inscribed on the direct surface of the mountain. And I think Geumgang Mountain has about 4,000 such inscriptions. So the mountains even belong to the great leader. You know, people were in the teachers who I was with found those mountains beautiful. I don't really, also the ocean it's amazing because right next to Geumgang Mountain is right above the DMZ. And I know what it's like on the South Korean side, which is all condos. South Korea is just like full, there's no, there's literally such a developed country. And North was empty, the beach. It's the most uninhabited beach I've ever seen, which actually people thought were beautiful, but is that beautiful? Clearly, human beings are not allowed to be there. So if the nature belongs to the great leader, then where do you even begin in a world like that to bring about anything that we're thinking? And I think that spending the time with them, it was a psychology that you start also understanding about their world, which is also, I would assign things like letters. They all had to write letters weekly. I insisted to the North Korean staff that I would have to have a letter written to see what were on their minds. Those letters were all about the great leader. More and more, it was very clear that they were also scared. But that took a long time for those letters to reveal their feelings. I did things like essay writing to try to see also their minds. They couldn't do it. Things like essay writing was impossible. And I didn't know why it was impossible until it was just lesson after lesson after lesson essays were impossible for them to do, and because essays are about critical thinking. It's about introduction, thesis sentence, supporting details, conclusion, which the things we take for granted, that concept doesn't exist. They didn't understand introduction, no matter how much I explained. And I would say, I would tell them, you know, it's like waving hello, but how do you do it in a way your reader will catch, you know, be seduced by what you're suggesting as your main idea, and they didn't understand. And, you know, because critical thinking is also a dangerous thing in that world. So, you know, it's there were so many of these details which you begin to observe, and these are the future leaders, how they really think. The lies in that country was also, my students lied all the time, which I found disturbing in the beginning, but slowly you also realize, what if you were educated, born into a system that were all lies? If everything you've ever been taught your entire lives have been lies, then do you really, are you encouraged to tell the difference between truth and lies? There were so many of these thoughts that I experienced while there, which actually, most of which I found frightening, but also very heartbreaking. I mean, frightening on a very basic level, because I was undercover. What that meant was I kept every note on USB sticks. Every morning and night, I wrote on my laptop, which I was allowed to have with me as a teacher. I wrote down every single thing, and then I transfer everything onto little USB sticks that I wore, like with on a necklace on my body always, and I erase everything off the computer. I hid the document within another document, so I would have these teaching materials in a Word doc, but then, you know, the real writing was buried within that, like would start from like page 100, so that if they ever looked through my stuff, then at least it wouldn't look like that it's I came out of there with 400 page notes. So, you know, on keeping these notes, which I knew were for them, obviously I would have ended up in a gulag if they found that. So I think it was frightening on a daily basis. But beyond that, I think on a human level, to get to know these young men, and realizing what was at stake was actually, you know, I've been covering this for a long, long time as a journalist, and what I found in North Korea, on surface it looks fine. I mean, it's poor, but it looks fine. But actually the deeper core of North Korea, I found it to be, first of all, we are taught by the media that the elites have it fine in Pyongyang. You know, Kim Jong-un and his friends are all partying and the rest of the country is starving. I didn't find that to be quite true. I thought it was kind of a system of Stalin where everybody is living under fear. But beyond that was, I think, so the lack of freedom was just on every level of this country. The control was absolutely beyond what I could imagine. But I think the humanity-wise, the psychology of what it's like to be born and bred there for three generations, while I think the rest of the world sat back. I mean, I don't know if any of that is something that one can begin to even heal, undo, or redo. So, I mean, these are amazing insights that actually broke my heart on a daily basis. Thank you.
Wow. Suki, some questions from our audience, of which I can see there are a lot. I'll start with one. Yeah, you write that it's in the government's interest to infantilize the population and to deprive them of any notion of objective truth. So Kim Il-sung is the world's greatest golfer because the government says so. What other proof do you need? And you suggest that that's going to be bad for science. And yet, obviously, somebody's doing some decent science in North Korea. They build missiles, they build... How does this happen? Can you speculate?
I think that one thing of that world that is really hard to fathom is also the reason, for example, I got in. You know, it's so compartmentalized. So in our world, informations are being traded, but it's sort of like a spider web of compartmentalization. And I had written about North Korea before, but I managed to go undercover because I'm not staff on any newspaper. I was never a staff reporter. So what that means is that there is a loop. I mean, there is sort of a gap in some sense. So if, you know, things like nuclear weapon building would be only that small sector. Not that different from hackers, you know, like sweatshop workers who only do that. So there is a sector that's obviously very skilled at science, but that's what they do. That's all they do. So that's being developed that way. And the rest of the country is remaining ignorant.
And yet they have to be educated in order to do their work. And education, you know, doesn't end at a boundary of a subject. So aren't they being critical thinkers, and don't they apply critical thinking to?
Well, you do what you're told. So I think the scientific department or a group of very talented scientists who would do things like building nuclear weapons would be very, very encouraged to do that only, nothing else. So, you know, if my students were college students majoring in science and computer, you know, obviously these were not your nuclear weapon buildings little group subset that would be pulled away differently. So, you know, when you look at that society, it perfectly makes sense that it's totally an isolated group that would be educated in that.
Suki, you have captured our audience. They're all terrified for you. Isn't your life in danger? Do you ever feel in personal danger from the North Koreans because of your book? Weren't you afraid of repercussions from your book wherever else you may have reported? Aren't you in danger?
Well, I mean, I think that the really scary part was going in there. I was terrified, I would say, every second. But it did become an obsession that I followed for over 10 years. So, you know, at some point, it's just a part of the whole package, really. After war, I did get a lot of threats. But, you know, what are they going to do? You know, the worst was being there. So when I do get those thoughts, I push it out of my mind. Most concern was actually the welfare of the students. You know, the evangelical organization, people wrongly thought I was putting them in danger. But they're working with the Kim Jong-un regime, that organization. You know, they were not in any trouble. They might have been reprimanded for letting me get in through them. But, you know, all they probably would have been punished was to raise more money for Kim Jong-un regime. Some church around somewhere was paying for that. And it's not like I don't have empathy for what they're doing. I mean, I think that they've got their own reasons, and I think some of their efforts are positive. I do think, though, if you're shaking hands with the modern day Hitler regime in order for long-term goal of your religious conversion to a population that's already vulnerable to one fanatic god, to go to another one, I think there's a moral question there. However, my focus was not the organization, it was the students. So how do you avoid the students will not be, you know, punished as a result of my book? I mean, if you read the book, the students are basically loyal to the regime, and it's impossible to tell who's who. And identification, I mean, changing names is a basic, but how do you make them that they all blur with each other? So that was actually a disservice to how amazing and beautiful and unique they were, but they were obviously, you know, make sure they are fine in the book. So that was probably the only thing that haunted me as far as safety is concerned.
Some of the questions that are being asked have to do with what you could teach. The book goes into great detail about the fine line you draw between teaching them too little and not teaching them enough to put them in danger. So I'm not going to focus on that. It's a bigger subject. What hope do you think there is that North Korea will change, will eventually abandon its super controlling aspect?
You know, that's a tough one. And I am of an opinion I don't see a way out. You know, I think after understanding it as much as I can, I'm just amazed at sort of so much false reporting about North Korea, false hope. It's really weird to me. I feel like in the outside world, we don't want to believe it's as bad as it might be. You know, people always counter. They'll be like, well, I heard that they're all watching soap operas in North Korea. And if they are, though, if they are, how do we have that world? You know, or they'll say, like, I heard that everybody's on the internet. And if it is true, then thank God, because I don't see the evidence of that. You know, it's the one place that's complete. How is this? I mean, you just saw a little bit of how is that maintained unless you wipe everything out of their, you know, they're not allowed any of that once the CNN crew leaves. You know, it's a little bit like that nightmare of like Cinderella when I was little. Like I remember reading it as a child and be like, well, when like people leave, they treat you horribly. You know, and that is pretty much, I think, what's going on in there. So if you have such an absolute control, there is no such a thing as a little bit of control, because Kim Jong-un regime is not going to survive. They're the first ones to go when that control breaks. You know, if you're fighting for your life, which is what all those guys are doing, I mean, Kim Jong-un, first thing he did when he got to the power was to kill off his uncle. Number two guy in North Korea was still not safe. You know, he was pulled away, not just killed or sent away. He was pulled out of a public meeting and publicly executed. This is a guy who's not only his uncle, but also basically, you know, Kim Jong-un was basically raised by Chang Sung-taek, the number two guy, his aunt's husband. But that guy was a part of Kim Il-sung, the original great leader's like main guys, Kim Jong-il main guy. So what that means is if you're not safe as Chang Sung-taek, every single relative of Chang Sung-taek was killed. Because Chang Sung-taek was number two guy for decades of North Korea. What that means is all his relatives were like, you know, ambassador to Singapore, whatever it was. They all had all these like, you know, prime jobs. They all got hauled back right after that. Children, down to the children, were all killed. So, and that's a familiar, I mean, we've seen that like in Stalin or Pol Pot regime, you know, where you just basically kill off everyone. So in that brutal system, I don't know how you can do it halfway. And also, we're also forgetting the whole cult ideology thing, which I think breaks down. You can't have half cult ideology. Fanatic cult is not like halfway. Because once you do that, it breaks down. So I think because of the essence of what North Korea is made of, I don't know how you can sort of soften that control and then being more democratic. Because once you do that, it's the end of those guys' lives. So I don't see a way out inside North Korea.
If you think of some of the dystopian novels, this is a rather delicate question, so bear with me. Things like Fahrenheit 451 or The Hunger Games, the society of those novels is no loopier than the one that you record, you tell us about in North Korea. So my question is, I know you're very sad about North Korea, but I sense from the book you're also somewhat angry. And I wonder if, I mean, without suggesting you've made it seem worse than it is, I'll ask the question backwards. Have other reporters from the West who had any chance to get firsthand experience been able to come up with a more optimistic view of North Korea?
As far as I know, there's no one who's been able to get in there without the permission of North Korean regime. What that means is they are under there with the permission of the North Korean regime. So AP's in there. I don't approve of what they're doing, because I think what they're doing is basically, news there is not news. You're not going there reporting. Reporting means like free, you go and interview people. So if it's like you're inside a gulag, basically the whole country is a prison, and you're getting a prison ward's permission to go interview this person, you know, who's fearful for his life, you're just not gonna get any answer. So there has not been any media who went there without the only way is undercover. It was far more brutal than I imagined. And brutality you hear from defectors are, you can't even stomach what they're saying. But I think the psychological abuse was beyond my worst nightmare.
I'm going to end with a softball question here. How did your students react to such a foreign concept as Harry Potter? Now, in the book, you learn that she tried to show it to all the students and finally ended up only being able to show it to a few. How can that experience help them be aware of the shortcomings of their government? Or did it chance to make them aware of the shortcomings?
I only showed it to them not because I was trying to like awaken them. You know, I'm not a fan of Harry Potter, although I think seeing anything Western probably was good for them. It was because they kept bringing it up. They kept saying, how about Ron and Hermione and Harry? And I thought, wow, how do you know this? Do you get this book? I know, as far as I'm concerned, as far as I know, North Koreans only get one foreign book allowed in that country. They'll tell you everything is allowed, but I mean, spending time with my students, the only book they really knew was Gone with the Wind. And I mean, it's not hard to know why, because Gone with the Wind, I mean, what is it about? It's about civil war. And also North winds. I mean, there's clear reason why Gone with the Wind is allowed. They call it Disappeared with the Wind. But Harry Potter, they all said, of course they read it. But then they didn't. Because I mean, they'll ask me things like, what about, it's called Quidditch in the book, which is a broomstick that you play the sports in the air. And they thought it was real. So they didn't know what it was. You know, they just heard this. And then I learned that it was mentioned in it. We were using an ESL textbook that it was approved to use it. Very outdated Chinese textbook. But because it was taught in China, that said it was okay. And the little passage in those ESL books always have little passages with vocabularies, happened to mention Harry Potter. And from that little story, they learn, they figure out, because you know, it's amazing, when you have nothing else allowed, little information, you soak it up like a sponge. So they all remember, all they realize is some outside, there's this really popular thing they're missing out on. So I think they kind of fixated on Harry Potter. So then I realized, I had this little dream that I want to show it to them. So how do I do that? And by miracle, one of the younger staff had a DVD with her. And I insisted, and I ended up showing it to them, just one small student group. And I really thought they would respond to all the special effects of Harry Potter. But actually, there was a moment in the movie where Hermione says, I have to write an essay for Professor Snape's class, and like rolls her eyes. And it was like the whole class went like, oh! And then afterward, they were like, Professor, Hermione has to also write an essay. Because I've been drilling essay to them so badly. And they were like, oh my, and she doesn't like essays either. Like, we don't like essays, and Hermione doesn't like essays. And for them, it was like they couldn't believe it. And I thought it was one of the most poignant moments, because they really connected. It was a connection to the outside world. And that's what stuck with them. One thing they're not allowed in that country.
Suki, if the only way to get the truth from North Korea is through the offices of an undercover journalist, and you're the only one we know of, we're very grateful to have you here. Thank you.